Our second guest tonight is the well-known American actor James Earl Jones, and this new book is titled Voices and Silences, and as I read the book, I discovered the significance of that title. It refers crucially to the fact that you and the spoken word have always been in some sort of dynamic but difficult relationship. And
At odds.
And there was a period in your life when you essentially either chose or felt you had to stop speaking for some 10 years or so.
What was stuttering was just so uncomfortable and painful. And at the same time, funny, you know. I think the showdown was when I was reciting my Bible verse in Sunday school, and the laughter just got too much. And I knew why they were laughing, because it's bloody funny, you know. Stutters are funny. And I know that the few attempts they've made to add the stutter into the comic format of TV sitcoms, and how much uproar there is over it, and how people have now evolved what is essentially the politically correct attitude about stuttering. I'm sorry, it's funny. Stutters are funny.
I found a quotation which seems to me absolutely relevant to what we have in this book of yours, at least when it comes to your formative years and how they led you to acting. This is by Isabel Adjani, who is a significant European actress.
Yes.
And she says, "I believe you can't be an actor if you haven't had the feeling of being abandoned as a child."
Whoa.
What do you make of that?
I don't believe that. It's like you can't be an actor unless you've also been a drunk. I don't know what.
But indeed, you.
I love it, but I don't believe it.
But you did feel abandoned as a child by your mother.
By both parents. But you see, it's not that I understood that there was a horrible depression on the boll weevil had wiped out everything, and that I was lucky to be adopted by my maternal grandparents. But I do understand that now, and I think at the time, being in the household of the grandparents was something I understood, and I wouldn't have. My mother offered for me to go with her to the Delta.
Yeah, you suggest that maybe the choice was that you made the choice to abandon your mother at the age of four or so. You were told you could either go with your mother or go with your grandparents.
Uh-huh.
And you decided to stay with your grandparents.
Yeah. It was set up, you know, because my grandmother made sure that I heard the loud arguments between her and my mother about the Delta, and which sounded to me like a dank, wet, dark place, and that they use goofer dust down there. And I'm like somewhere between three and four and a half years old. By the way, I found out recently, I might have mentioned in the book, that a New York Times study exposed the fact that the plantation owners of the Delta were allowed to dispense cocaine by the thimble for each morning to the workers. They just open the shirt and plop it in, and because it sort of increased the productivity of the laborer. And this is what my grandmother was talking about.
It was the opium.
It
was the opium of the masses, so to speak.
Well, it was the cocaine of the.
It was the cocaine of the masses.
The grain harvesters. Yeah.
You originate from down in Mississippi.
Uh-huh.
What's the name of that town? Ark.
Arca Butler. Yeah.
But when, and of course you basically did live with your grandparents, your maternal grandparents.
Yeah.
And then they moved to Michigan. Mm-hmm. Your grandfather, who's a very hardworking, interesting, strong man, was a farmer down there, but he did other kinds of work. And then he decides to move the whole family up to a new homestead in Michigan.
Yeah.
When you're how old?
I'm now four and a half when the move happens.
And so up into the rural reaches of northern Michigan.
Lower Peninsula, yeah.
Yeah. And that's where most of your memories come from.
Yeah.
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 What was that life like?
It was good. We didn't know it was poor. We had an expression that when you really felt good, when your belly was full and you were warm and you weren't wet from the rain, you felt rich. And it was like, I think the Jews have a phrase, you kvel, you know.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Kveling for us was feeding rich. And that was the only time we ever used that phrase. We never used it in terms of economics. We never had a situation of worrying about keeping up with the Joneses. People had a car. We had the first car, I think, my family had the first new car of anybody in the county, even in Mississippi. So the idea of transportation had become an important one in 1932. And it was the same car that they drove, my uncle and my granddad drove from Mississippi to Michigan in. That car served us for a long time. But aside from having transportation, we didn't have things as luxuries. We farmed with a horse, horse-drawn vehicles, and everything was pretty much manual.
If you go to, say, the age of 10, which is an age in which consciousness has more than dawned, and attitudes towards self and the development of some kind of sense of self has more than begun. Who were you to yourself around that time?
I don't know. I was a member of a family that worked and protected each other, you know. It's a wonderful question, but I just said I had a nap too recently. I can't get that one.
But you weren't an unhappy kid. Even though you had struggles over your stuttering, and even though essentially you withdrew from linguistic communication with much of the rest of the world.
I think children have to have something to compare to before they can deal with concepts of am I happy or unhappy. Mm-hmm. I discovered later in life the African concept of contentment. I think they would have written in their constitution not the pursuit of happiness, but the achievement of contentment. And that's much more realistic. Happiness isn't necessarily a comparative thing, isn't it? And I think contentment is kind of universal. A baby feels content when his mouth falls away from the nipple and he's asleep. And those moments before that must mean contentment for a child. You know?
One of the great mysteries of existence, it seems to me, is how people come to the work that they do. Sometimes it's a kind of accident, but it's always the right accident, or else you're pushed into something that just doesn't work for you and that is a burden for as long as you do it. Maybe you're condemned to it for all of your life. You found your métier in acting. How did you come to acting? How did you know that this was the road to some kind of personal fulfillment and personal attainment?
Well, starting way back, the idea of choosing a career didn't occur to me until one day I was in the field with my grandfather. And, farming was a way of life. Farming was what we did. Farming was how we lived.
And you thought in those days you'd probably become a farmer.
Most of the kids I knew. I was the only kid of the 17-member graduating class to go to college, because most of them were farmers, and they went on to their father's farms, and they were, you know, sufficient. And that defined all of us. And the idea of something else didn't occur to me until that day in the field, when the wind was blowing the manure in my face and I was momentarily upset. And my granddad, in his uncanny way, said, "Well, what's the matter? Don't you like farming?" And I said, "Not today." And he said, "Well, what do you want to do? Be a doctor? Like laying it in, you know?" Mm-hmm. And I said, "Yeah." And it was as casual as that. And until I gave up pre-med, that sort of defined what I would do, you know.
You went to the University of Michigan, and there you entered as a pre-med student, and you found the science courses.
I call it force-feeding a goose. I mean, science in high school was fascinating. And I don't know whether it was because I had good teachers or because of the sort of the minor league level of science as taught in high school, but I think it was because of the way it was taught. And at University of Michigan, a large place, they just simply lined us up and tried to force feed the goose, and I bolted. You know?
I've already told you privately, you and I were students at the University of Michigan literally during the same years.
Yes.
But we never met.
I was too busy being force-fed.
And you were too busy with the beginnings of your acting career, because it was... How did you first discover at Michigan that this was something you might do, and how did you first learn that it was something you enjoyed?
I think because of the rediscovery of speech with Donald Crouch back in high school, and the few things I did to help learn to speak better, like reading Edgar Allan Poe from the stage, gave me a sense of that was a good exercise, you know, that was a good thing to do. And so when I decided after being disenchanted with pre-med, and with the Korean War looking me in the face, I figured if I didn't get into med school anyway, I'd be in Korea the fall of the year of my graduation and probably dead by the winter. I said, let me do something I know I will enjoy. So in my junior year, I concentrated on the drama department and had some fun there. Clarabelle Baird and Halstead. I mean, there was a wonderful staff of people. Mm. Baird and Halstead and Wendt. Valentine Wendt was teaching directing. And
so they were the ones who first defined for you the nature of the art of acting.
Uh-huh.
What was their view? What was their definition of what it is to be an actor?
It is hard. I think they had an easier time teaching the students of costume design and set design. To teach an actor, you had to have a good acting class. You had mm-hmm. to have a bunch of kids who had some innate talent. And then you began to challenge each other. Then you began to reach. You began to try to define your roles and to try to interact with more excitement, you know. And I had a good class, you know.
They weren't following the famous method, necessarily, were they?
Most universities, I think, still feel obliged to give the actor technique, actors. And the same way that if they found an innate painter, they wanted to give them some, good, strong techniques of painting. And they felt obliged to do that, you know. Method. I didn't encounter the method as we know it until I got to New York.
They basically did the technical side of acting. Diction, movement.
Yes.
Probably taught you even how to fence
movement,
or something.
Yeah.
Some ballet courses, maybe, or something like that. Dance courses, at
least. Don't remember my getting that fancy. and I would have considered it fancy in those days.
Yeah.
It wasn't until after I'd finished the Army and got the macho out of my system that I could go to New York and study Afro-Cuban dancing as part of my acting training.
And you must remember,
shame.
You must remember your very first occasion on the stage in an ensemble doing a play. What occasion was that?
Well, that was, the Hillel Foundation on campus one year put on... Oedipus, mm-hmm. as some say, and I played the chorus, a one-man chorus.
Really?
And that was my first time before I went down to the Arts Theater in Ann Arbor, doing what I consider professional, I mean, not professional theater, but the real stuff, you know.
What did you do at the Arts Theater? That was a professional company downtown.
Yeah.
What was your first play with them?
The Sleeper Prisoners, Christopher Fry.
Mm-hmm.
We played it. We got permission to use a church, a real church in Ann Arbor, and we played it there.
I imagine you haven't kept track of the total number of stage appearances you've done, but they're given in this book in an appendix towards the end. Did I say, I only said it once, the new book by James Earl Jones, Voices and Silences, has just been published. It's an absolutely enthralling autobiography. It is co-authored by Penelope Niven, who's an excellent writer and biographer. Indeed, she's been on this program about 2 years ago for the biographical study she did of Carl Sandburg. And I see her in the studio, though she isn't on the program tonight. I want to say hello to her shortly. Do you have any idea what the total number of stage appearances, I'm not talking about film or television, but stage alone, is that you've done?
No, I don't.
I don't mean the number of actual performances, but how many different plays?
I've lost count.
It's in the hundreds, obviously.
Is it really? Oh,
it's a very impressive list back here. When your career...
Part of that number, I think, came out of that ravenous period that I had when I discovered myself in the middle of a revolution in New York,
mm-hmm.
An artistic revolution. I came out of the Army expecting that it would be the other kind that I'd
have. You were in ROTC, you went into the Army and were an officer for a while.
Yeah.
You could have gone on with an Army career, but you...
I considered it.
Yeah.
I really liked the Army. When I was on a mountaintop one day, and Colonel Willoughby said, do you want to go for captain now? And I said, yeah, probably. He said, well, let me ask you, is there anything outside that you have considered doing? He was a man, I think, who thought about the future in the Army, and knowing that there was problems like alcoholism rampant in the Army, and knew that the cause of that was often sort of a discontentment, you know. And he wanted to make sure that he didn't encourage somebody to stay who really wanted to be out, you know. And he found out that I sort of hankered to go out and try acting.
Mm-hmm.
I said, my dad's an actor, and I've considered that. He says, I think you ought to go out and try it. You can always come back to the Army.
You've just made reference to the artistic revolution that was going on in New York in the drama world when you arrived there. We're going to bring you there right after we pause for some commercials. I want to go into New York, into your reunion with your father, Robert Earl Jones, who was an established actor, and into the training you did and the early plays you did in New York and the beginning of that great public career with which we are all by now familiar by virtue of your accomplishments over the last 20 or 25 years. All of that to follow right after these words.
Okay. From WGN Radio Chicago, you're listening to Extension 720. Once again, your host and moderator, Milton Rosenberg.
And we return to James Earl Jones. We are drawing from his excellent new autobiography, Voices and Silences. The book is of great value. That explains my verbal slip of just a moment ago. What year is it you come into New York and start your
I was about
career?
To explain about what the revolution I expected and the one I found. I had been carefully listening to all the rhetoric going on in the civilian world. Malcolm X was coming on strong then. When I came out of the Army, I fully expected there might be what is described now in Bosnia, ethnic cleansing. I thought maybe a race war was pending. And I may have to do what young Bosnians, Muslims have to do, take up arms in guerrilla conflict. So I came out expecting that, and what I found was an artistic revolution that sort of superseded all that. They gave everybody a chance to address issues through the theater. And having had the theater training I had, and I was coming out to get more, I became ravenous about all the opportunities there are off-Broadway. And I think the number of plays I did were increased during that period. I used to go from act one in one play to act three in another, you know, and just slicing off as big a piece of the apple pie as I could.
One of the plays that first brought you to wide public attention and got you a great deal of critical acclaim was Jean Genet's play The Blacks, which had a very distinguished cast, a number of people, all of whom have become quite famous actors since then.
Everybody of the African-American community that you might know of in the theater, like Cicely Tyson, Maya Angelou, Raymond Saint-Jacques, Lou Gossett, Robert Hooks, Billy Dee Williams. I could go on and
they
on.
Were all in.
Abbott Lincoln. We were all a part of
even the comic
Godfrey Cambridge, yeah,
was in there.
Yeah,
yeah.
And some of us were in it at the same time. Others would recycle and trade off. You know.
Also, during those years or shortly thereafter, you got very involved with Joseph Pepp's Shakespeare productions.
Yeah.
You did a lot of Shakespeare.
Yeah, I remember. Leroy Jones had a play called The Dutchman, and it was wonderful. And then he had another play, and he kind of expected those of us who had started to get our feet on the ground, he said, "No, come and do play with me." And I said, "No, I think I want to go work with Joe Papp." I remember how outraged he was that I made that choice instead of playing with him. But Joe was offering us chances to work with some of the best writing in the history of Western literature. And even to start out carrying a spear was something very exciting for us, you know. And I was a spear carrier in the first production.
Which production was that?
It was Henry V. I was not aware that Michael Weedums was an important character until the reviews came out and they began to compare Michael Weedums, a black soldier in the English Army, with the black soldier in Vietnam, arguing with the captain. You know, Weedums is the one who takes on the king. The king comes out on the battlefield,
not knowing that it's the king.
Yeah. And they had this wonderful dialogue about the responsibility of those who get killed in unjust wars. And the public, you know, the critics knowing that Joe Papp had been blacklisted and was this leftist thinker, got very excited about that kind of casting. And all Joe was doing was getting a bunch of husky boys up there on stage to be the soldiers, you know. And
Does it ever bother you that these days, in this phase of your career, when your name comes up, the first association, lots of people, not all people, not theater sophisticates, but lots of people will come up with their the first association being, oh, yes, of course, Darth Vader.
I love that.
Do you love it?
For a generation that wouldn't have cared about King Lear. I'm glad I can relate to more than one generation. I was upset when that first started happening, and I meet people today who say they saw it 20 times when they were 10 years old, and I said that's addiction, and I didn't understand it. And now that my son has the same kind of addiction with Nintendo, I'm trying to understand it better.
Mm-hmm. Well, we come to your films again. I think there's a very, very large number. I'm just turning to the list, and what do I discover? The very first one was Dr. Strangelove. Now, that's a great film. That's Stanley Kubrick's film. You are one of the members of the bombing crew that delivers the bomb to the Soviet Union. Is that
and
right?
The key to that was, this was a farce.
Yeah. I mean, oh, yes, it's a great farce.
And the key to that
it's
was...
It's a very bitter farce.
Yeah, yeah. That Kubrick wanted the bomber crew to be representative of all... a rainbow coalition, mm-hmm. you might say.
Which is what we used to do with the Second World War.
That's right. Black guy, Jewish guy, Irish
exactly,
guy, Canadian guy.
Yeah.
And when Kubrick came to check George C. Scott out, because he knew he wanted George to be the general...
That was he was General Jack Ripper.
Yeah,
Jack
D. Ripper.
Jack D. Ripper,
yeah.
Yes.
And I was playing the Prince of Morocco, and George was playing Shylock in Merchant of Venice. And so when Kubrick saw George, he also saw me. He said, oh, I'll take him too, you know, because he knew he wanted to have that rainbow
mm-hmm.
coalition.
Mm-hmm. Mm,
quite inadvertent that I was cast in that.
And then you went on, of course, the third film you made after The Comedians, the third film was The Great White Hope. And that indeed won you, I guess, an Academy Award nomination. It was the film version of the play you had done on Broadway and was the beginning of your great public celebrity, I would suppose. Mm-hmm. It was the dramatization of the life of Jack Johnson, the first black heavyweight boxing
I think the
champion.
Stage play outdid the film. In spite of the way the movies are disseminated, I think the stage play was more broadly known and appreciated than the movie was.
I never saw it. I did see the film, however, and I thought it was a fine film. As I run through this long list, here's another one that I saw only recently, though you made it way back in 1976, and it's from a novel written by a friend of mine who resides in Chicago, The Bingo Long Traveling All-Stars and Motor Kings.
Oh.
Did you have fun with that one?
Yes, Chicago slaughtered this. We did that knowing it was a comedy, and some of the, I guess, more liberal critics in the urban areas were outraged that we in Hollywood would waste our time with this frivolous comedy when we could have told the tragedy of the black baseball players, the Negro Leagues. You know?
Well, they didn't feel tragic at the time. Most of them probably had a good high time.
Well, they might have. People like Josh Gibson became an alcoholic because of the disenchantment, but he was not so disenchanted with the black league. It's just when Jackie Robinson integrated the big leagues, that was the end of the Negro Leagues.
Mm-hmm.
And then the disenchantment started.
This list does go on and on. What films stand out for you? You can't feel equally fond of all of them, obviously.
I feel most fond of plays I've done, and I can name ones that I would love to leave as my legacy.
Mm-hmm.
I can only name a few movies, and it does not include, unfortunately, the Bingo Long or any of the large movies. It includes only the small movies.
Which ones?
Like Matewan, The Man, which was actually done for TV, Claudine.
It's interesting you mentioned The Man. We were talking about that privately during the last commercials, weren't we? That's the one in which you become the first black president of the United States.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's one of your favorites.
It became. When we first did it, I was frustrated because we started out doing it as an ABC Movie of the Week.
Yeah.
It came out the year that Robert Redford had great success with The Candidate. So the powers that be said, well, it's a good year for politics. Let's package this now as a movie. Everybody who participated in it, who created it, were upset because in those days there was a big difference between money spent on movie as contrasted to TV and time spent. And had we known they were going to push it out as a movie, and this is Barry Diller's decision, we would have said, give us more time and more money. But it went out there, it flopped as a movie. But when it was finally released on TV, it was very successful. And I became aware of how good it was years later when I looked at it and I saw that by comparison to much of what else is on TV, it was quite eloquent, you know.
What do you take to be the nature of the actor's art when you come right down to it? Let me try out another quotation on you, or perhaps two of them. Here's Katharine Hepburn, of all people, who says, it's of acting, it's such a cuckoo business, and it's a business you go into because you are egocentric. It's a very embarrassing profession. And here's a very different view by John Cassavetes. Acting is an extension of life. How you're capable of performing in your life, that's how you're capable of performing on screen.
Ooh.
You want one more?
Yeah.
Just to absolutely stir the pot? Well, I mentioned Hepburn, so here comes Spencer Tracy, who's got an ultimately practically realistic view. His advice to actors is just learn your lines and don't bump into the furniture.
I think that one...
Does anyone come close?
Well, I think Tracy's would last us all longer. Hepburn's is the most interesting, I guess, because one assumed that that's probably true, and yet I don't think it is anywhere near the truth about egocentricity.
Mm-hmm.
What you do... You lend yourself to a character. You lend yourself to a playwright for a moment. And there is nothing more selfless than that, if you do it right.
Explain what you mean by that.
You stand backstage before the curtain goes up,
yeah,
and you let yourself go for a minute. You let yourself sort of rest. James Earl Jones, rest. Out walks Lenny. That's got to be selfless, or else it doesn't work. Yes, you carry out your pride as a human being. You lend that to Lenny, but your ego, no, it doesn't belong there.
Well, who's capable of doing that and who is not? It's probably not a skill that all can learn if they apply themselves assiduously to the training.
I think the method, philosophically, is designed to help you do that. To help Marlon Brando is the actor who most is capable of lending himself to the character.
And when you speak of the method, of course, you're referring to what the Actors Studio did by way of transforming the Stanislavski technique, which American actors have taken seriously for the last 50 years, I suppose.
And all Stanislavski was interested in, he said, hey, look, nature has given us a guide. There's a thing called human behavior. Let's act according to the way humans behave. And it was really going back to nature in a way. And the group theater and the Actors Studio took that. I think Lee Strasberg is probably one of the most aware men about not how to act, but about what the art of acting is about than anybody since Strasberg. I mean, since Stanislavski.
Mm-hmm. Did you, in fact, study with Strasberg?
Yes, I did.
You went to his...
A short time, too short a time. I was with him for a year, and I don't think I got past more than three sentences. He spoke in clauses.
Uh-huh.
He never ended a sentence. But if you hung in there long enough, you learn something. Not how to act better, but you learn something.
Yeah.
Quite interesting about the mystique of the art of acting.
There is a kind of fraternity, a kind of bond between actors, which is very admirable and enviable as well, I suppose. I've known actors and I've known acting companies in my time, and to be able to create something together, I think, binds people much more than lots of other kinds of activity.
Yeah, and you find that on stage, I think, more purely than in film.
Yeah.
In film, you can have an actor's ego really getting in the way. I mean, Ms. Hepburn might be defining Hollywood rather more than Broadway, more than theater. You can have an actor... I once did this thing with Agnes Moorehead. One of the first things I did on TV, there was a series called The Defenders, and she played a regular on that, and I was a guest. And I remember being frustrated by it didn't matter whether I was there or not. Off camera, she was doing a performance pretty much oblivious of me. And I said, what is this? You know, I thought, hey, she's got to connect. She's got to connect with me. And when I saw it on film, it was wonderful. She was all there. She had learned as a actress in the media to do it by herself, because you're so often working with a jerk who's not giving you anything.
Yeah.
She didn't know I was there available to give her anything.
Yeah, she came from a great stage tradition. She was one of the original Mercury Theater that Orson Welles organized.
But her adjustment to the film was that you find your relationship with that camera. She was wonderful.
Yeah.
But that mystifies, it still mystifies me how one finds that relationship with the camera and is capable of doing without the fellow actor.
Who do you find now to be the great actors of our time? Who are the ones that really move you and that you think you could learn from?
I could say Marlon Brando 12 times and count that as an answer. There are others who are good, though. Gene Hackman is one. The young Italian actors, De Niro and Pacino, are wonderful. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a crop of young black actors coming up too now, which includes Forest Whitaker, young man I work with quite often, Courtney Vance. What's great about it is that it is an organic thing. It's not just the icons you plug in up there. Yeah. It's it's an organic evolution of talent, you know.
We've got some commercials coming in a minute, and we would like to work in some phone calls after those commercials, so we'll open the lines again. And, of course, the number, as ever, is 591-7200, 591-7200, and the area code 312 if you're calling long distance. Now's the time to get your calls in for questions to James Earl Jones. 591-7200, and we shall return directly after these words.
This is WGN Radio Chicago, and you're listening to Extension 720. Back now to your host, Milt Rosenberg.
And directly back to James Earl Jones. We are drawing from his excellent new biography, Voices and Silences. You expressing some doubt during that last commercial break. I always tell what people say during the commercial breaks.
Good.
As to whether this is a biography or something else.
Well, when I look at Malcolm Brown's, the average American would say, yeah, this guy's going to tell us something. This is a biography. And when you think of the biography of an artist, he says, well, what is there to tell except what he does, you know?
But you tell a great deal. I think you do connect your early years and your great involvement in the mystery of language and the barrier that language poses, or whatever barrier stands between you and the effective use of language, and then your mastery of that barrier, and then your discovery of acting as a great fulfillment and as a legitimate high craft, and how all of that is woven in with aspects of your personal life, even your rediscovery of your father, whom you didn't know during all of your childhood years, though he was and is, even to this day, a significant actor.
You're right. I probably would have ignored him if I had not become an actor. Yeah.
And then there's a good deal of stuff, something I found quite fascinating, in a chapter towards the end of the book about your own personal life and about your little mountain or hill home up in New York State. And that conveys a great deal about you and what your attitudes are.
As fast as I fled the farm after that day with the manure in the face, I'm as fast fleeing back to it now.
Yeah. Let me once again say that we've got our lines open and we'd be glad to have some telephone calls. We've got about 14 minutes in front of us and we'll be getting to the phones in just a moment. The number 591-7200. Some lines are taken and some are available for the taking. 591-7200. Get your calls in instantly if you want to be heard. I am constrained to ask you, what about that other phase of your career? The great American voice, at least on television and on radio. You show up in commercials and so on. You show up in narration.
Uh-huh.
And you are, I think, the voice heard hawking the Excellence in Broadcasting Network. Is that what it's called?
What?
Am I wrong in that?
The Excellence in Broadcasting?
The Rush Limbaugh thing?
Oh, yes.
That is you, isn't it?
You know, when you do a TV series, you're obliged to go to those junkets, you know, in a hotel room. They'll have everybody lined up. It's like going, like, whoring. You know, you go from one whore to the next, you know. Or you the whore-serving customer. And you walk in, and when you do the interview, the network or the show or the whatever, the talk show will say, do our logo. And they'll put a mic in your face. And they mean it. Do the logo. This is CNN. This is WGN, whatever. Mm. For the day your interview is going to air. Well, Rush keeps using it.
It's there every day, yes.
I haven't challenged it because I kind of get a kick out of it. But it's bootlegged.
Is it? I see.
Yeah.
But it is odd. Of course, course, you have a great voice. But voice isn't all that makes an actor, obviously. But people keep commenting on your voice and seek your voice, obviously.
Luckily, I had teachers that warned us, don't listen to your voice. Don't fall in love with your voice, because when you start listening to it, nobody else will.
Mm-hmm.
That voice is only sound, and at worst, noise, unless you're saying something interesting and clear.
Let's go to the telephones. The number 591-7200. If you want to get a call in, do it quickly. 591-7200. And here is the first caller. Good evening. Hello, are you there?
Hello.
Yes, sir.
Yes, I'm curious what your opinions of the industry today, whether you see it going on the upside or on the downside.
Which industry do you refer to, sir?
Well, the broadcasting and movie industry.
Well, is it going up? One of the fascinating things about Hollywood, especially, is you never know. Broadway, the theater tends to die and rise like the phoenix periodically, and you never know quite why. It has to do with the resurgence of young new talent, usually writers and actors. Hollywood, you might have a good year for everybody in the next year. We seem to learn nothing. There's no wisdom out there. And we're like a bunch of lemmings running around trying to find everybody else's trend, you know.
Very short memory, I guess.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah, unfortunately, yeah.
And you better get a better car radio, or rather a car telephone.
Ah.
591-7200, our number, 591-7200 for a conversation with James Earl Jones. Here is the next. Good evening, you're on the air.
Good evening, gentlemen. Mr. Jones, I just was wondering, for the voice of Darth Vader in the Star Wars saga, now, I can't remember correctly, but were you Darth Vader, the voice, in the first film also?
I was in all three. I denied it for the first two. A lot of people said, gee, that also sounds like Jeffrey Holder, and I encouraged that thinking. The reason I denied it, by the way, because back when they did The Exorcist and Mercedes McCambridge did the voice of the devil coming out of Linda Blair, there was a big controversy as to should Mercedes have credit, especially if Linda got an Oscar. And I thought that was kind of silly, and I didn't want to get into that kind of thing, so I just said, well, no, I'm special effects. David Prowse is the actor playing
Did you audition for that?
No, not really, but I think when Lucas realized he wanted a dark, more bass voice, he probably thought of Orson Welles, and then he eventually asked me if I wanted the day's work, and I said yeah, and we went in and did it in 2.5 hours. He paid me a nice salary for it, and $700 or $900, $9,000, something like that.
And quite a trademark.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I thank you much for your time. That's nice of you to take the time out to talk to me, and that's pretty much what I needed to know.
Thank you.
Thank you,
sir, for the call. And here is another. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to tell Mr. Jones that I think it's having him on the screen, I think it's refreshing that he brings such a certain amount of class and decency to the screen, which seems to be lacking today in our motion picture industry. And it just seems that everything that he does with regards to film, I don't think any would be ashamed to see it. I wouldn't be ashamed to let any of my kids see the things he does. I just think he's just a really classy guy, and I just really appreciate the class and the type of work that he does on the screen. It's nice to see it.
I'm having a great pleasure hearing you talk, not because of what you're saying, because you sound like Kevin Costner.
Pardon me?
You sound like Kevin Costner, except for your Chicago inflection. It's a thrill to listen to you.
No, it's not. But I just really think it's really refreshing. I enjoy all the stuff you do, and
Have you seen James Earl Jones' most recent X-rated movie?
Yes. No, I haven't. No, I'm really happy to see a gentleman of his caliber and the class that he brings. Because I don't ever see any tabloid crap about him in the the Globe and the National Enquirer. And I just think more people should consider him a standard of the industry.
My biggest ambition is not to be written up in the Enquirer.
You do live a very simple life, don't you?
Yeah.
That is off stage and off screen.
Yeah.
You and your wife and your one child, how old is your son now?
He's 11.
He's 11.
He'll be 11 in December.
And a lot of time in that place up in New York State that I mentioned.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And we are.
Uh-huh. 591-7200 is the number. Good evening. You are on the air.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello. I was wondering, Mr. Jones, you have such a wonderful voice. I was wondering, have you done any books on tape?
No, there are actors who do it very well. I find that impossible. Because of having been a stutterer, there's some conditions in my brain that are not unlike dyslexia. And I have a hard time stringing thoughts together. Still, I have a hard time. I can have a conversation as we're doing now, but I cannot give extemporaneous speeches, and I have a hard time reading books. I can read. I can do a commercial, even of some length, if I study it, but I can't read a book and make sense of it.
But you mean you can't read it out loud? What about private reading for yourself?
Oh, I can. Yeah,
you do a good deal of it.
Yeah, not enough, but I do. I do too little pleasure reading. I read mainly as research, you know.
Here is yet another caller. Good evening.
Good evening. Hi, Mr. Jones. How are you?
Hi.
I was curious about some work you've done with Phil Alden Robinson. Field of Dreams is probably my favorite movie ever, and you were absolutely inspiring in it. And I really enjoyed the cameo that you did in Sneakers.
Yeah.
I gathered when you showed up for a small part in that meant you really enjoyed working with Mr. Robinson, and I was wondering if you could tell me what he's like and if you plan on working with him in the future.
Boy, I'd like to. He's working on something now about the 60s activism. I think SNCC. He's got a project about SNCC coming up. He hasn't asked me to be in it, but I would drag my butt through broken glass, as they say, to work with Phil Robinson.
Was that his magical experience? Watching Field of Dreams was one of the absolute most magical experiences I've ever had in a theater. Did you know you were making something special when you were doing it?
He was smart enough to let the magic come from you. He was smart enough to keep that movie so simple that the audience became subjective when they watched it, and whatever relationship you had with your father, that became a part of the movie. If there was magic, it was because it allowed you to have your imagination. There was no attempt to do really special effects about that cornfield or to try to justify what other world there was out there. It didn't get fancy, you know.
Does that movie work magic for you? And I'm also curious, and last question, and I'll just hang up and listen to you. What films you've been in that still work magic for you that almost make you forget you were in them?
Well, it did work magic. When I sit down and watch that movie, I start crying when the music starts.
Mm-hmm.
A movie like Mate One, when I see that some of those scenes that Haskell Wessler designed for John Sayles, it's just like I'm watching a painting, you know. And I do forget that I'm in it.
Well, that's great. I appreciate your time. You're an absolute gem, and we're lucky to have you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir, for the call.
Bye-bye.
And you are on the air. Good evening.
Good evening.
Yes, ma'am.
I agree that Field of Dreams was an absolutely fabulous film, but I just wanted to say that the thing that made one of the greatest impacts on me was Harold and the Boys. I just thought he was fabulous in that.
Thank you.
And I don't know if that's one of your favorite things, but I still can see you up there on that stage. I saw you at the Goodman. And I really felt that was a magic moment for me of understanding a great many things.
Yeah, for me, all of Athol Thugard's plays were very special. He had a talent in not only creating elemental men, as far as the mature black actor is concerned, but also writing plays that were affected the way people felt. He always accepted the fact you couldn't make people change. He couldn't change people's minds.
No, exactly.
But he could change their hearts.
Well,
he offered plays of the enormous and affecting and moving experience, human experience. You know.
Well, I did just want to tell you that, and as the other callers have told you, that we appreciate someone of your caliber up there for us.
Ma'am, thank you for the call.
Okay, bye.
And I think we have room for one more quick call. Here it is. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, I just want to say we really enjoyed Mr. Jones in Gabriel's Fire, and I wish ABC had renewed it.
Do you have a minute to talk about that? I think if we'd done and kept Gabriel's Fire here in Chicago, it would still be on the air. The problem with making a series work is that you have to make not only the pilot work, and we had a great one, I think, having shot it here, but you got to make the next six episodes work. And by the time we disconnected from Chicago and got out there in Hollywood, everything fell apart. All the production concepts were wrong, the writing concepts are wrong, and I wouldn't doubt it, the acting concepts are wrong. And we could not, by the time we did get it right, six episodes later, it was too late. The ratings had already damned us, and we were off the air. And I think if it's not good enough, it should be off the air.
But it was so wonderful. It was a fantastic program, and we really enjoyed you.
Can I tell you a story about that? They had me out here in, what's your prison here? Stateville.
Stateville. Yeah. Yeah.
And you have a group out there called Con Artists. Convicts who also mm-hmm. are in an acting program.
I see. Mm-hmm.
Well, I had a scene with a character in the movie, a kid who insults me and walking up down the line in the prison there, and Gabriel grabs him and slams the kid against the wall, and we did this against the bars. We did this several times, and it wasn't until after it was over. And the actor was released, and he didn't go to our area. He went back to the prison. I said, "Well, who was that?" I thought he was a great, you know, he had sent to Hollywood for a great stunt double and a good actor. He said, "No, he's a killer. I mean, you've been slamming a killer against the wall all day." And I said, "Well, you know, his eyes were getting bigger and bigger as we did each take." And I'm glad he didn't know he was a convict. And I would have had certainly great, much more respect for him. Had I known.
Ma'am, thank you for the call.
Well, thank you so much. Good night.
We've got about a minute left. I haven't broached this all night, and a minute isn't enough time to do it, but except for an occasional reference to the fact that you're a black man, as we all know you are, we haven't talked about the role of the black artist in American society.
Well, am I glad. I don't have very much to say about it. Unless you want to debate the issue of race, and I don't. A lot of it is not that it's better ignored. It's just I think we give race and racism too much credit.
I think I agree with you. You also draw a distinction between racism and racialism, which seems to mean a good deal too.
Yeah, I borrow the word. I don't know what Webster meant by racialism, but I use it as to indicate that racism that is essentially defensive, that is a reactive rather than aggressive or offensive, you know.
It seems to have just become trivial and unimportant when it comes to your life and your art, and that's always
the case. It's insanity.
Yeah.
And how can you rationalize or debate about insanity? It's nuts.
Just ignore it where one can.
When you can.
Yeah.
And make sure it doesn't turn you into one, you know.
It's a fine study written by a very honest and a very interesting man. Voices and Silences by James Earl Jones is the book. It's just published by Scribner's. And I thank you, sir, for joining us tonight.
Thank you.